Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later on in today's program, we're going to discuss the new ProPublica and Frontline documentary, The Rise and Fall of Terrorgram, which examines the troubling rise of a transnational online network of extremists accused of inciting acts of white supremacist terrorism on the messaging platform Telegram. But first, we're going to focus on the plight of nearly 300 Venezuelan immigrants who were deported to El Salvador on March 15th and then immediately transferred to a notorious maximum security prison in San Salvador. According to the Associated Press, earlier this week, lawyers hired by the Venezuelan government took legal action on behalf of these prisoners from Venezuela seeking their release from the prison. To provide an update on the situation and the media coverage, we're joined by Roman Gressier, the English editor of the Central American news site El Faro and the host of the weekly El Faro English podcast, Central America in Minutes. And Roman is joining us from Guatemala City. Good to have you with us, Roman.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
So, Roman, before discussing the predicament of these Venezuelan immigrants now jailed in San Salvador's notorious prison, I wanted to ask you about the political landscape in El Salvador. Why El Salvador? What about its president, Nayib Bukele, who's now become a trusted friend of Donald Trump? Can you just give us an overview of the situation in that country and why this is the country that's receiving these immigrants?
Sure. Where to begin? Yesterday, the state of exception in El Salvador, which suspended multiple constitutional rights, hit the three-year mark. And in El Salvador, estimates by civil society monitors, human rights monitors, place a number of arrested individuals around 85,000. And some of the rights that have been suspended in the past 3 years include the right to what's called in Salvadoran law, effective defense, people being tried in group, at times up to hundreds of people at the same time. And that's something that we've been reporting on since the first months of the state of exception by like mid-July 2022, and by that time, by August of 2022, the country was already destroying the peacetime record of habeas corpus requests that were being filed. So basically, the prison system is calibrated such that people who enter into the prisons enter into a black box of uncertainty in terms of, and this also applies to the recent deportees who were removed from the United States, Venezuelans and Salvadorans. We don't necessarily know for the Venezuelans which judicial system should respond for them. And if it's the case of El Salvador, well, then we know that the state of exception has been enforced for 3 years and they're subject to the same basic conditions as the broader Salvadoran population. Now, as for your second point, for the Trump and Bukele alliance, yes, since Bukele was sworn in to his second term, which was prohibited by six articles of the Salvadoran Constitution in June of last year, he has solidified an alliance with Donald Trump. This dated back to Trump's first term as well. They were close. At least rhetorically, and they met once officially, and they have again solidified that. Now Bukele has positioned himself in the ensuing years as a personality in far-right U.S. media, and I think that probably contributed to the closeness that we now see very publicly with the Bukele administration and their eagerness to pursue aggressive immigration and deportation cooperation.
We're speaking with Roman Gressier, English editor of the Central American news site El Faro. He's joining us from Guatemala City to talk about the latest about what's happening with Venezuelan immigrants to the United States who have been deported to El Salvador. And just speaking on Nayib Bukele, this president, he was elected on a promise to end gang violence. So this is all part of this crackdown. But I'm wondering if you could tell me, Roman, where are they putting all of these people? How many jails do they have here at this point?
Well, there's an archipelago of facilities, many of which are notorious. You could cite Zacatecoluca or Mariona or others, Izalco. These are all like maximum security prisons. And under the state of exception, there have been multiple reports dating back to mid-2023. by human rights monitors pointing to the committing of potential crimes against humanity in these facilities. Now we're talking about torture. They've alleged a systematic policy of torture of detainees. And then there's about 300, over 300 people who have emerged, who died in Salvadoran custody in prison. And many of these, as El Faro has documented the past 3 years, had signs of torture on their bodies when they were removed from the facilities. Though in the autopsy reports, these were described as pulmonary edema. So there was a bit of euphemization of the evidence in the official autopsies. But this is happening across the Salvadoran prison system, with these facilities that I mentioned being kind of the big blocks of it. But then the quote unquote Center for Confinement of Terrorists, which Bukele constructed in the past few years, this is kind of the shiny media facing prison facility, where any access, which is not granted to Salvadoran media, but is granted at times to YouTubers, influencers, mm-hmm. or international U.S. media, is very tightly curated. So that's where you see these scenes of, you know, alleged gang members in lines and running around the facilities, or simply facing the cameras. These are all, you know, you could call it, as the old saying goes, lights, camera, police action within the facilities that's designed and tightly controlled to communicate what the Salvadoran government would like to the international media.
Well, I know some cabinet officials, Kristi Noem, for example, has posed in front of these prisoners, using them as a prop, essentially. And President Bukele's tactics have sparked significant international criticism. Human rights organizations have highlighted a lot of the abuses that you've mentioned, and there's been just general concerns about the growing authoritarian nature of his rule. But how popular are these policies with the average voter in El Salvador? How is President Bukele viewed by many down in El Salvador?
Bukele and the state of exception both poll very well, according to the best polling that we have, which among others is done by Central American University, their public opinion institute. There are others too, but that's the biggest one. And you know, in the past couple of years, polling for Bukele has been very consistent. I think there's a dichotomy in which, on one hand, yes, all polling indicates that Bukele is very popular, you know, putting his support within 80 to 90 percent, sometimes maybe 91-92% support. And on the other hand, these same polls report that, for example, 6 out of 10 Salvadorans are afraid of expressing opinions in public. So I would say that there's a twin dynamic of popularity and fear that coats the Salvadoran political discourse and how people interact with that discourse.
And do you have any sense, Roman, just how many innocent people have been swept up in this crackdown? Do we have any idea?
Yeah, human rights monitors estimate that possibly as many as 30,000 innocent people have been swept up. But those are estimates. And again, as for the strict number of how many people have been arrested, we're relying mostly on official figures. And right now, the number is around 85,000, according, you know, as of yesterday.
Well, let's shift focus here and talk about now the plight of these Venezuelan immigrants who have been deported, nearly 300 of them, to this facility, these facilities in El Salvador. Can you talk about just an overview of the situation now? What happened? How did they get rounded up and sent down to El Salvador? And what's the current condition there for them?
Well, we don't really know what the current condition is, because it's a black box. And what we've seen at El Faro are mainly the U.S. reports right now. The U.S. government has detained and deported these people, claiming that they're, you know, members of Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang. But we don't know, for example, how that has even judicially been asserted or proven, or whether that's just the loose accusation of a DHS official who saw a tattoo on an individual. There are cases that have been exposed in the press, and I'm sure many of your listeners have seen them in the U.S. press too, of people who, you know, had a tattoo. There's one man who had a Real Madrid tattoo from the renowned soccer team, and was swept up because DHS asserted that it was elusive to gangs. And so these are common situations. We don't know exactly on what grounds they were accused of being gang members. We just know that both governments initially accused them all 238 if I'm not mistaken, on the number of being members of Tren de Aragua. And then they both rolled that back in recent days and said that there was also a contingent of undocumented immigrants who were also deported to El Salvador.
So if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm hosting Your Calls Media Roundtable today, and we're talking about the plight of Venezuelan immigrants to the United States, deported to a notorious prison in El Salvador. We're joined by Roman Gressier, the English editor of the Central American news site El Faro. He's also the host of the weekly El Faro English podcast, Central America in Minutes. He's joining us from Guatemala City, and I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines. If you're a listener and you've been to El Salvador or Venezuela, if you know someone who's been affected by these roundups, you have thoughts about what's happening on the ground there or what should be happening here in the United States, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the program is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And if you have a question or comment you'd rather email, that email address is yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Roman, we've been talking about how we really don't have a good sense of why and who has been rounded up in, among these Venezuelan immigrants. As you mentioned, it seems like some of this is just based on tattoos. But what is happening to these people once they enter that prison? What kind of due process, if any, is there for them?
Again, we don't know exactly what is happening to them because it's effectively a black box, the Salvadoran prison system. And again, with the state of exception now hitting the three-year mark yesterday, fundamental rights to due process have been dismantled. They've remained that way. Every month, the state of exception, which under the Constitution should you could have extended it one time. It had to be truly for exceptional circumstances. And now we've just hit the three-year mark. So what was once exceptional is now the norm, right? The dismantling of due process.
And for these immigrants from the United States, they have family here in this country. What are lawyers doing? What are they saying? And what is the government here in the United States saying about what the process is going to be for these deportees now going forward?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that people, you know, have right to defense in the U.S. system, but I'm not sure how the Venezuelan contingent of deported people to El Salvador in recent days, how that shook down with their defense attorneys.
And right now, so there's no communication between family members and those who have been deported down there. Is that correct?
I would say I'm about 90% sure that that's the case. We're talking about a prison system where thousands of people to date still don't have any information about their relatives who were detained, you know, months, if not up to 3 years ago. Many of them have at least obtained some indication of what facility they're being held in, but then they have no other information. And that's just common run-of-the-mill prison conditions for Salvadorans under the state of exception in general. And that certainly applies to anybody being held in Salvadoran custody.
And Roman, how are you able to cover this story? How are you getting access to details of what's happening? How have you been able to cover just the rise of these prison facilities in El Salvador?
Well, El Faro as a whole is covering this very closely, and I edit the English edition. So I work with the reporters who are directly working with sources and uncovering what's going on in the prison system. And then I've also done some reporting over the past 3 years of my own on the state of exceptions. It's a bit of a combination, but as in with my editor's hat on, you know, I've touched all of the reporting that we've done on this in the last 3 years.
And have you been concerned for your own personal safety or the safety of any of the sources that you've been talking to get this reporting out?
Not for my own safety. I live in Guatemala since June 2021, when the Salvadoran government de facto expelled me from the country. So I'm not in the exact line of fire for any type of retaliation for our reporting personally. Although there's always a risk that sources who speak with El Faro, you know, they just put a target on their forehead if they're not careful. And that's an individual case-by-case consideration that's basically just become, you know, part of the fundamental fabric of doing journalism in El Salvador under a state of exception.
I wanted to ask about that. Just what's the general state of trying to report on stories in El Salvador? What is the conditions like for media just within the country?
Yeah, it's really interesting because at the start of the state of exception, the government approved what was denounced by the Salvadoran Journalists Association as a gag law, and you know, they said that the point of the law was to limit messages alluding to gangs and stoking fear in the population. And that law was later struck down. But the broader conditions for journalism in El Salvador are very, very challenging. There's basically a strangulation of access to public information. There's virtually none, at least public officials and public information. At times there's some reports, but really what you're relying on are official statements by a minister, once every couple of months in terms of the arrest figures, for example. Basically the Institute for Access to Public Information, which would be as if there was like a FOIA institute in the federal government, specifically dedicated to ensuring those rights, has been fundamentally dismantled in recent years in El Salvador too. So you don't have access to that type of information. And then there's also surveillance, which dating back to 2020 and 2021, there were dozens of three dozen confirmed cases of the use of Israeli Pegasus spyware in El Salvador. 22 members of El Faro, including myself, we were part of that group that was detected as having been surveilled using Pegasus. And I would say that's another element of it. And there's the digital hostilities toward reporters and, you know, smear campaigns and whatnot. And El Faro in particular, actually, in April 2023, we moved our judicial or legal inscription or incorporation, our papers basically, to Costa Rica. The government had accused us of, money laundering. President Bukele personally accused us of being subject to a serious investigation for money laundering. And they had also mounted multiple baseless tax audits against the newsroom. So we actually moved our entire incorporation to Costa Rica 2 years ago now. It's kind of crazy how time flies. Yeah, and so those are the general conditions. They're very challenging. There are also colleagues who have left the country either semi-permanently into exile, or who at times leave the country in sensitive moments when they're working on investigations.
You're listening to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking to Roman Gressier, English editor of the Central American news site El Faro. We're talking about what is happening on the ground right now in El Salvador, which has been the recipient of almost 300 deported Venezuelan immigrants from the United States, now being housed in a notorious prison facility in El Salvador. And if you want to call to join the conversation, if you have questions for Roman about what's happening in El Salvador, what's going to happen for these to these immigrants who have been deported, the number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And Roman, just talking about what's happening in El Salvador on the ground, President Bukele has cracked down on these gangs that we've talked about a bit, but what my understanding is that now filling this void of the gangs has been police and military action. Can you talk about what is happening in some of these communities that were previously under the control of some of these gangs? What has replaced that gang activity?
Yeah, that's right. El Faro published in early 2023 a report on 13 very emblematic, formerly gang-controlled communities across El Salvador who are no longer subject to that control due to the sweeping mass arrests, which essentially dismantled the gang structures or hierarchy and the historic connection between leaders in prison and leaders on the streets. That's not to say that there are no gang members left in El Salvador on the streets. It's only to say that the fundamental structure and the way that the gangs exercised a control, according to our investigation in February 2023, has been fundamentally dismantled. Actually, a month ago, mid-February, we published a photojournalism special for those of your listeners who like photography and photojournalism. We published a four-part special, 50 photos in total, showing the evolution of violence in El Salvador from the civil war to gang control to the state of exception. And in the latter case, where the police and military who work hand in hand through a militarization of civilian security wield basically complete power and discretion in these communities to wield state violence. And that's where the accusations or the evidence of human rights abuse have also emerged under the state of exception.
So we have an email in. Rob in San Francisco writes, why did El Salvador agree to this all for $6 million? That was the payment that I understand the Trump administration has sent to El Salvador. Can you answer that question, Roman? Why El Salvador is agreeing to receive these Venezuelan immigrants?
Sure. To Rob's question, I think that the Bukele administration has very eagerly positioned itself as a close Trump ally. Bukele was not particularly private about the fact that he was hoping that Trump would be elected over Joe Biden. And, you know, he did on one hand have the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, at his inauguration, but an unconstitutional inauguration. I'll remind your listeners that there are 6 articles of the Salvadoran Constitution that explicitly prohibit consecutive presidential terms. But that was discarded by the Bukele-controlled Supreme Court. And on the other hand, at his inauguration, there was a very wide contingent of U.S. conservative politicians and influencers that included people like Donald Trump Jr., Tucker Carlson, a former U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, Ronald Johnson, who was there from 2019 to until Joe Biden's inauguration in January 2021. And all of this was setting the stage for close cooperation. And I think that Bukele's willingness to put anything and everything on the table in terms of migration, Stephen Miller, White House senior advisor, even said as much prior to Marco Rubio's trip to the region, to Central America, which was his first international trip. I think Bukele was eager to communicate that there would be a very close relationship. And on the receiving end, after Trump was elected, we're talking, well, actually while he was being elected, this is on election night, Bukele had congratulated him and stressed that he was hoping, or that they had discussed the sometimes perverse use of USAID funds to fund the opposition in El Salvador. So he very much forefronted in the conversation U.S. funding to groups who Bukele has branded as the opposition. So to Rob's question, I think there was a bit of a tit for tat. There was aggressive, frontal, everything's on the table, migration cooperation. And on the other hand, what was at least publicly put on the table was the question of U.S. funding to quote unquote opposition groups.
And anything else that might be in the mix, could Bukele be profiting personally from this arrangement? Do they expect favorable trade deals, more support? Anything else, any other indications of what else El Salvador might get out of this arrangement?
I certainly don't know that. We'll have to see.
Yeah. Well, on that topic of what we'll see coming up, what else are you monitoring right now? What are some big milestones coming up that you're looking at? And what else are you working on?
Well, we're looking at the Honduran elections, neighboring Honduras, which will be in November. They just held primary elections, which were very turbulent, and there was mudslinging between the two institutions tasked with monitoring the electoral process, which are the army, which is headed by the current ruling party candidate, Minister of Defense as well, Rixi Moncada, and then the CNE, or National Electoral Council, which is currently, you know, they rotate it between the three major parties, is currently being run by a national party figure, which is an opposition party. And so they were mudslinging between each other over who had allowed the chain of custody of ballots to be broken in some cases in the two major Honduran cities, though monitors, including from civil society, stressed that the process had been carried out mostly cleanly. So we'll have to see what happens, but the tensions are certainly spiking, and the defense minister and ruling party candidate constitutionally has to resign by the end of May because the army, which she oversees, is the guarantor of the electoral process. So we're closely watching that in Central America. And and our podcast, just Central American Minutes, just today, we covered the release of the order of safe passage granted by the Panamanian government to former Panamanian President Ricardo Martinelli, to allow him to go to Nicaragua to claim asylum. He had already claimed asylum, but this will allow him to formalize that process. And he had actually gone there in February 2024 to evade an over 10-year sentence for money laundering in Panama. So those are some of the stories that are on our horizon and what we're covering these days.
Well, you definitely have your hands full, it sounds like. And El Faro is really El Faro is really a wonderful site.
Can you
just talk about how you're sustaining yourself, what the business model is? Is it subscription? How can listeners support or access your reporting?
Yeah, we have about 80% grant funding, private grant funding. And then we have as well a crowdfunding program, which listeners can find at support.elfaro.net. And that accounts for a little over 10%, I believe, as of last figures. And then we also have, you know, royalties for books and movies and a variety of things. And that's basically the broad strokes of how El Faro is financed. And yeah, anybody who would like to support independent reporting from Central America, I would certainly invite you to go to our website at support.elfaro.net. And we'll also invite you to events with our reporters and other perks. So
wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we'll have a link on our website as well. But Roman Gressier, English editor of the Central American news site El Faro, host of the weekly El Faro English podcast, Central America in Minutes. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Call, especially from Guatemala City. It's been wonderful to have you on.
The pleasure has been mine.
And next, we're going to talk about the new ProPublica Frontline documentary, The Rise and Fall of Terrorgram. So stay with us. We'll be back just after this short break. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at kalw.org. Just click on News and Your Call. You can also listen to our past shows there. And if you have a show idea for us, you can let us know anytime. You can drop us a line at our email address, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also call us, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So now we're going to discuss the new ProPublica Frontline documentary, The Rise and Fall of Terrorgram, which examines the troubling rise of a transnational online network of extremists accused of inciting acts of white supremacist terrorism, all on the messaging platform Telegram. Joining us is the film's co-producer and correspondent, AC Thompson. AC is an investigative reporter with ProPublica and a correspondent for the PBS series Frontline. He's covered the rise of extremism for more than a decade, and The Rise and Fall of Terrorgram is now available to stream on YouTube, the PBS app, and Frontline's website. Good to have you with us, and thank you for this really important and quite alarming documentary, AC.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, AC, just to start off, what sparked this extensive investigation? I mean, as we see in the film, you're really traveling all over the world to cover the story. So how did it begin for you?
It's a tragic story. I mean, really, like, honestly, it started with me following what happened after the manifesto in one of these mass shootings was released to the public, and then seeing how it circulated through this Telegram ecosystem, which was a collection of chat groups and channels on the messaging service Telegram, and how the mass killer was turned into a hero because he was a white supremacist who had targeted Black Americans in a store in Jacksonville, Florida, and murdered them, and then put out a manifesto celebrating this murder. His manifesto moved through the Telegram scene, and he was hailed over and over and over again as a saint, as someone who should be emulated by the followers of this scene. And for me, that was sort of seeing how that had happened in one incident. I wanted to understand better, like, what's going on here?
And how were you able to track that story then? It seems like you did the work that you would almost hope that authorities would be doing in tracking the links, how these shooters had their online profiles. You were able to go back and identify who they were, essentially using a lot of different online tools and just some sleuthing. So how did you end up pulling all this off?
You know, the challenge, I think, for law enforcement, for journalists, for researchers with a platform like Telegram, which has nearly a billion users, is that it's not particularly searchable. it's not particularly transparent. It's not like going on Facebook or Instagram or X. It's quite different. And so, you know, what we needed to do was build this basically archive of the Telegram chats, of the Telegram channels, the accounts, the communications that span many years. A lot of people contributed to those, different extremism researchers. We worked with a company called Open Measures that has a social media analysis tool that's focused on alternative platforms like Telegram. And we basically built a huge database of these communications. We tracked a bunch of these basically terror influencers in real time. We got into private chats, and then we were able to start identifying people. Oh, okay, this guy who keeps posting under this name, well, he's been arrested in Arizona and Tennessee, and now we can figure out his real name. You know, this guy, one of the big things that we did was we identified a user who had basically grown up in this community, who was started in the community when he was 16 years old. And we figured out, okay, this is the username. People didn't know it before. And we were able to see how he was sort of influenced for many years to become more and more radical, and how finally he then went out and committed a terror attack.
It's incredible how you're able to uncover this whole network. Do you feel like this is work, though, that authorities should have already done? That, I mean, it shouldn't have been open to a journalist like yourself to uncover this? Is this something that really our law enforcement, maybe if not even in the United States, but just globally, should have been on?
Yeah, there's really, I have really like kind of two thoughts about that. And like, look, so there was definitely some like very thorough investigating going on this platform. There's now been a bunch of different arrests made around the world. There are still people who were very active on the platform in encouraging acts of terrorism who have not been apprehended or charged in any way, and maybe are liable for criminal charges in multiple different countries. There were arrests starting from, you know, 2019 when the community really developed. But yeah, it's in some ways, I think there could have been more that law enforcement did. And in a lot of ways, I think the real responsibility here lies with Telegram. This is a company that, you know, we got intelligence bulletins about this company from 2019. And law enforcement back in 2019 was saying, hey, we're seeing a pattern here. ISIS is using Telegram a lot. But when they put up a channel and start talking about engaging in terrorism, it gets taken down pretty quickly. On the other hand, the white supremacist extremists, the people in this Telegram network, when they put up a channel, they're able to operate pretty freely without much interference. And they had identified this double standard all the way back in 2019. And what we really saw was that over the span of 5 years, from 2019 to late 2024, you had thousands of people who are participating in this white supremacist terrorism community. You had hundreds of chats and channels, and you had this just constant messaging of like, here's bomb making materials, here's poison materials, here's hacking tools, here's 3D files for printing ghost guns circulating through this scene. And really, Telegram's moderation and ability to kick these people off their platform was really quite limited. They did, I would say, a very poor job at kicking this contingent of people who were advocating terrorism and recruiting potential terrorists off their platform.
We're speaking with AC Thompson, investigative reporter with ProPublica and a correspondent for the PBS series Frontline. We're talking about the new documentary, The Rise and Fall of Telegram. Love to open the phone lines and hear from you if you've been able to watch the documentary. I know it just came out, but if you have questions for AC, if you want to know more about how white supremacists are organizing, sharing information online, the number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with questions or comments at yourcall@kalw.org. Well, AC, let's talk about Telegram. It was interesting how you described its origins, really founded by a Russian billionaire headquartered in Dubai. And as you say, it became a source for how ISIS could communicate. But I was also struck that there were activists in places that were a lot of censorship, places like China that were relying on Telegram. And, you know, it's not like all of this communication is necessarily negative or evil in this case. Can you just tell us more about Telegram, its background, and how it functions?
Yeah, it's a great point. So no, Telegram is technologically a remarkable tool, and it is very cool in many ways. And it has been used for all kinds of pro-democracy organizing all over the world, in Iran, in Hong Kong, in other places. It has been an essential comms tool for people who are fighting for basic democratic rights. It also has become, in many ways, a hive of scum and villainy. And it was shocking to me, as I spent a year on the platform, to see some of the things that were happening there on a regular basis that you just simply don't see on other mainstream platforms with, say, a billion users. And that would be like people selling illegal guns. There was a man who's facing charges in New York right now. And I got into his accounts, his chats, and he was selling illegal guns from his federal prison cell with a cell phone. I mean, it was shocking. There's people selling stolen checks. There's people sharing hacking tools. There's people, pushing around child abuse material. It is the kind of stuff that you just simply don't find on other big mainstream global scale platforms. So that is a big concern. And I would say that the company has done better in recent months in moderating and pushing some of this stuff off the platform. And they've brought on a bunch of contractors to deal with this. And it's definitely, there have been some improvements, but it has been shocking to look at what is on that platform.
And what's the state of regulation of Telegram, particularly in the European Union? As you pointed out in the documentary, the founder of Telegram was actually arrested in France last summer because of what was allowed on this platform.
Yeah, you're looking at this sort of situation where you have varying regulations around what can be shared on platforms, this kind of stuff around the world, whether you're talking about Brazil or Australia or the EU. And so there has been some pushback from authorities in different jurisdictions involving Telegram. The big thing has been the criminal case out of France, where the allegation is, hey, you just let people engage in really awful criminal activity on your platform, and you should have dealt with it. That matter is ongoing. You know, I don't know where that's going to go in terms of whether it will actually eventually go to trial or not. But that's the sort of complaint that law enforcement and civil society forces have had around the globe, is like, this platform just can devolve into this hub for overt criminality.
And let's talk about how white supremacists were able to really take advantage of this platform. In the film, you talk about how the white supremacist march demonstration in Charlottesville back in 2017 was really a pivotal moment. And of course, that was the moment that, as Joe Biden said, really inspired him to run for president. At least that's how he characterized it. And a protester, counter-protester to those white supremacists, was killed during the Charlottesville demonstration of these white supremacists. Can you talk about how Charlottesville led to these far-right white supremacists using these online platforms?
Yeah, after Charlottesville, that movement really went in two different directions. And there was a group that said, we want to be more acceptable. We want to continue to operate in the public face, in the public space. We want to, adjust our iconography and our image to be more palatable to more people. And then there was another faction that said, no, we're not doing any of that. We are going underground and we are going to engage in terrorism, because in their minds, there is no political solution for the problem that they see, which is they believe, these white supremacists believe, that their perceived enemies are running the globe and they are losing. and they want to overthrow modern democracies and replace them with white ethnostates. And so they said, you know, that's not going to happen through the political process. So we need to start killing people and do as much as we can to burn these countries to the ground.
It's really disturbing how the site is radicalizing some of these killers who otherwise don't seem to have any indication of even subscribing to some of these ideologies. And you have what you describe in the film as the first ever interview with the father of one of these shooters who, according to him, really had no idea that his son was being radicalized. Can you tell that story for listeners?
Yeah, that was an interview with John Ernest. His son, John T. Ernest, engaged in a mass shooting in 2019 in San Diego County. He attacked a synagogue there. He killed one person and shot others who survived. And as we understand it, both from the father and from law enforcement, you know, really in the span of about a year to 18 months of being in these sort of extremist internet spaces, John T. Ernest became convinced that he needed to engage in terrorism and that he needed to engage in terrorism on behalf of the white race. And that's what ended up happening. For him at that time, he was spending a lot of time on 8chan, which is a message, a kind of no holds barred message board. It's where the QAnon conspiracy fantasy took hold. And, you know, it's the kind of place where you can say horrible racist stuff and be celebrated and applauded. By the end of 2019, after there had been three mass shootings that were closely connected to 8chan, including the John T. Ernest shooting, a lot of people started migrating to Telegram because 8chan started moderating much more closely. And it also was shut down for a while as a result of its connection to all these attacks. When people moved over to Telegram, and there was a concerted effort by white supremacists to migrate to Telegram, they posted threads on 8chan saying, let's go, we're gonna go over to Telegram, it's gonna be better. When they moved over there, they found like, oh, actually we have more freedom and more latitude here by far than we had even on 8chan, which was a pretty Wild West kind of scenario. And that really for 5 years became the sort of hive mind for the extremist scene. And it still is for some of these white supremacist groups.
You're listening to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind. We're talking to A.C. Thompson, investigative reporter with ProPublica and a correspondent for the PBS series Frontline, about the new Frontline episode, The Rise and Fall of Terrorgram, which examines the troubling rise of a transnational online network of extremists that are accused of inciting acts of white supremacist terrorism on the messaging platform Telegram. We'd love to hear from you if you have questions about how these online sites work, what is being done to address them. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We did get one message from a caller who is off air and wanted to know if there are now moderators on Telegram who can find and expel people doing inappropriate stuff online. And AC, I know you mentioned that Telegram has hired some contractors. What is the possibility that these individuals could be expelled based on what they're posting on Telegram?
You know, so what we've seen is definitely a lot more moderation going on. And the company says it's hired about 750 contractors to try to work on this issue. We are seeing, you know, the Telegram network, which grew to be hundreds of channels, thousands of audience members, has basically been dismantled. And so we know that there's definitely more moderation happening on the platform now. But there, you know, I am worried that that may be a blip and that, you know, we may see all of this stuff return in the future, or that it's going to move to another platform.
it does feel like a game of whack-a-mole in trying to crack down on these types of online discussions. And I wanted to ask you about how you were able to access some of the folks you interviewed. It's really striking to me in watching this special Rise and Fall of Telegram. I mean, you go to Bratislava, an old town in Slovakia, and interview one of the shooting victims. Her two friends were killed by one of these white supremacists. They were outside of a LGBTQ bar in Slovakia. You also talked to one of the imams at a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand, that had that horrific shooting there. And of course, as we talked about, you had able to track down the father of the shooter at the synagogue. Can you talk about how you were able to access these folks and get these really extraordinary interviews?
You know, we just had an incredible team. So we had really great field producer in New Zealand who made connections for us and had connections in the community that made that possible. We had a really great partner in Slovakia, Lukáš Diko, who's an incredible investigative reporter, who introduced us to everyone we wanted to talk to and really furthered our reporting there. And when I said, hey, I think this is the account for the terrorist, the Slovakian terrorist who attacked the LGBTQ bar, I was like, am I right? Is this actually Slovakian language? He said, oh, yeah, that's Slovakian. And yeah, I think that's the guy, and really helped us pin that down, you know. So it was a team effort, and we had just a really excellent team.
And I couldn't help but watching the film, thinking about what's happening in the United States right now, essentially the purges at our Department of Justice, the FBI. I mean, these are the agencies that you would rely on in this country, at least, to be monitoring what's happening online and taking legal action and prosecuting anyone who is found inciting this kind of violence or preparing for this kind of violence. What do you make of the politics in this country? Do you think it's going to affect the investigations and in the enforcement and monitoring of what's happening online?
Yeah, it's incredibly concerning. It's incredibly concerning. So there's a few pieces of this. And one of them is that the money that had been going to doing programming around countering violent extremism or de-radicalization, that does not seem to be happening anymore. My colleague, Hannah Alam, has reported on that for ProPublica. What we are hearing about people who were working in what would be called the RMV space, so the racially motivated violent extremist, the white supremacist space at the Department of Justice, is that does not seem to be a priority for this administration. And we'll see what happens going forward if they continue to build cases against people like the Telegrammers, or whether they look in other places at other individuals. But, you know, our concern is that there may not be a lot of excitement about doing those types of investigations right now. And I think, you know, we have to say it, that you had a massive group of domestic extremists who were involved in besieging the Capitol on January 6th, who have been pardoned, freed from jail, and are being celebrated as political prisoners by the current administration. And the people that did those investigations are being apparently targeted by the current administration. So that really sends a pretty chilling message to people about domestic extremism.
Well, I note that there are figures like Sebastian Gorka, who holds racist Islamophobic views, now serving as deputy assistant to Trump and senior director for counterterrorism. It feels like, you know, the foxes are really guarding the hen house here. We do have a question from Janice in Berkeley, who writes, what can parents do so that their kids do not get sucked into these dark spaces on the internet?
That's a great question. It's a really, really good question. And this question came up over and over and over again in this reporting. I mean, the first thing is to try to be as aware as possible of what your children are doing online, and be aware that in many of these spaces, young people, particularly young white men who are lonely, are sad, are depressed, disaffected, are targeted for recruitment to these types of groups, these types of white supremacist and terrorist activities. And you need to be constantly talking with your child about what's going on in their life and where they're going online. You know, almost every one of these cases I've looked at had a component that was involved a lot of online time in very ugly places.
And AC, what are you following now? What do you think might happen here with these online networks? What stories are you tracking, or do you think that we should be aware of big decision points coming up?
One thing that's been remarkable to myself and other people that cover this beat is the way a lot of this white supremacist and neo-Nazi activity has shifted back to the biggest mainstream platforms, and the way that there is a lot of organizing and a lot of proselytizing happening on the mainstream social media platforms as they've rolled back their moderation policies. So I have some concern about what will be flowing from those platforms in the future. Now, to be clear, I'm not seeing bomb-making manuals on the big mainstream platforms, but I am seeing neo-Nazis, you know, holding court, and that's concerning.
Well, we're going to have to keep tabs on this issue and also on your work coming up. I just want to thank you so much for joining us, for doing this really important film. I think everyone should definitely watch it. It's The Rise and Fall of Terrorgram, now available to stream on YouTube, the PBS app, and Frontline's website. AC Thompson, investigative reporter with ProPublica and correspondent for Frontline, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Ethan.
That is our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. And we're also on social media. We'd love to hear from you there. And you can also email us with any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.